Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. Hard as it might be taking over from your dad to run the family business, it must be even more difficult to follow in his footsteps to a senior position in another company or corporation. But that is what Niall Coghlan did when he became head of sport in RTE. Then in 2004, he left the state broadcaster to become co-founder and CEO of Sustanta Sports Ireland, a position he held for 6 years before accepting the role of director of broadcasting for TV3. After a brief stint with Sports and Broadcasting Solutions, an international sports consultancy and brokerage business. Finally, in 2017, he went out on his own with the establishment of Coghlan Media, which works with sports broadcasters and rights holders, specialising in large and small scale productions, as well as broadcast strategy, rights acquisitions, exploitation, activation and delivery. Niall, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Now, I'm going to ask you, before we get into the nitty gritty of it, I'm going to ask you, what makes a good TV sports programme?
To me, I guess most of the work that I did was based around coverage of events. So let's start there, I guess. Let's have an event that people want to see. And let's let people see it with in the best way possible. Give them the best seat in the house. That's the old cliche, but it's amazing how often that seems to be forgotten in the delivery of it. And then I guess I would lean very heavily into the side of the school of thought that reflects the fact that this is entertainment. And yes, you want to have integrity and let not be spinning the event to make it something that it isn't. But my starting point was always people are watching this because they're passionate about it or because they're trying to take a break from their real lives where the hard stuff is done and this is supposed to be fun. So a bit like Bob Rutella's golf theory, get out of the way of it.
Yeah.
So I suppose good surprises are the product to me of what the entertainment business is about. So if we were to define the products we're making, it's good surprises.
Yeah.
And by that, if you put that with a good event that people want to see, then you can come up with a version of it that would fit into the entertainment category.
And do you think there are certain sports that lend themselves much more to the TV experience than to the live experience? The in-person experience, I should say, rather than the live one.
Oh, I would say so. Yeah. I mean, I think you could argue that properly presented, you will get a much better experience looking at broadcast coverage of an event than being there. Not that being there very often isn't actually a better experience to understand it in a different way or to appreciate it in a different way. For example, golf.
Yeah.
You can go to the Masters and have the experience of being there or the Irish Open or any golf event. But you won't actually have a better understanding of what's going on while you're there. At least not according to the traditional way of following, which I guess means who's leading, what's happening on the leaderboard. And that, I suppose, is a good example. Golf is a particularly good example of that because there's so many theatres of activity happening simultaneously. But even in a football event, maybe more so in something like rugby. When you've got 10 cameras there, you know you're going to give a better view of the action.
You're picking up a lot more than the naked eye is necessarily.
Exactly, and replays. And you've got people whose job it is to have researched who's playing, what numbers they're wearing, and usually also people with insights to tell you what's actually happening there, rather than being limited to your own knowledge or the big mouth beside you who's got very strong views on what the referee should or shouldn't have done.
Probably very little knowledge of said same thing.
Sometimes, but sometimes much more knowledge than a commentator actually will have because it's their passion. And again, it's a different experience. So I love going to sports events and I'm... and I love watching sport on TV. So, but it's two different things, really.
And is it a very different experience when you're in the production booth watching the thing? Do you actually see the sport at all in the production booth? If you know what I mean?
You do. Again, I suppose depending what role you're playing there. If so, I spent a long time as a producer. I spent a long time as a director, as an editor, and very often as a director, I would get to the end of a match. And I wouldn't be able to tell you what the score was. I'd be able to tell you what the margin between the two teams was.
Yeah.
But I used to say that that people who are very passionate about the event are often not the right person to be in the director's chair because they might actually want to celebrate. And I've seen it where, you know, the Tipperary hurlers get a last minute goal to turn the match around. And the director is arms in the air when in fact what's needed then and the sequence that will often follow a score in any sport will be close up of the scorer, perhaps close up of the keeper who might or might not have saved it, crowd reaction shots, close ups and wide atmospherics, captions to make sure the score is updated, the first replay. You want to get to it quickly, especially in hurling when the ball is going to be out again immediately.
Yeah.
Then perhaps another replay, if you have time, that will show you, add to your knowledge of what happened. Usually the first, often the first, again, depending. So, I mean, for example, let me talk about football now. Football to me now takes an endless amount of time to get to the first replay.
Yeah.
And not only that, but very often the broadcaster will take the score caption off just at the precise point I want to know.
What's the score now?
So again, these are taste and editorial decisions. But to answer your question, very often, depending on the role you're in, you not being a follower or a fan can be an advantage. We used to call them ball watchers.
Yeah.
And you know, the term kind of explains itself.
Talk to me through the move from the state broadcaster into the commercial space. And then, if you will, from a kind of a large company structure to a smaller company structure. The pros and the cons. We'll do the state to commercial first and then the large to the small.
Well, first, maybe if I explain what was my trigger to move.
Yeah.
So I had been... RTE at the time was the only one doing sport.
Hmm.
TG Cahir were dabbling in it at that stage. So this is back in the late 90s. Early noughties. And RTE had more sport than it had airtime to show it. And more money, more sport than it had money to process, to produce. I had made a pitch to the managed senior management that RTE should launch a sports channel because they're just, we actually own more rights than we had airtime to exploit. My proposal was declined, not for bad reason. They had lots of other things other than sport that they were responsible for. And I understood that. I had also been lobbying hard to the Premier League to release a 3 o'clock live match into the Irish market. The background here was that Sky owned pretty much all of the Premier League. Mm. It was a pay sports Best model.
Sport, yeah.
And their footprint, their satellite footprint and their encryption footprint spanned the UK and Ireland. So unlike their predecessors, BBC and ITV, they bought rights for both territories, the UK and Ireland. And they couldn't exploit the 3 p.m. match because of the FA had a restriction. That slot was protected so that people wouldn't be discouraged from going to see matches. But that didn't apply in Norway, didn't apply in South Africa. they were able to show that 3 p.m. match, and I had been asking Premier League to release that as a package into Ireland so that we could show it. And so I got a phone call from Richard Scudamore to say, do you remember that idea you had been talking about for the last 6 years? Well, we're doing it. 6 years ago, we didn't understand what you were talking about when you said it. 3 years ago, we understood, but we weren't interested in doing it. Now, we're doing it. So I said, fabulous. Went back to my board of management, said, I have a great success here. And they said, we have no money. Sorry. So after all that exercise and work, I was now facing the prospect that somebody else was going to get the benefit of all that investment of time. So what I did was I went back and I had a look at all the rights commitments that hadn't been signed, all of the cash that might be able to be gathered together to put, and I came up with what I thought would be about 50% of what I anticipated. We hadn't had discussed any numbers, but I knew that they weren't going to go below a certain threshold. So I had 50% of what I thought would do. And I had an idea because I'd heard that the guys in Setanta, Mickey O'Rourke, currently of Premier Sports, and Leonard Ryan had acquired rights to the SPL. I didn't know what they were going to do with it, but it was a UK play rather than an Irish play. And so I rang up, I rang them up and I said, would you like to meet? And they, and I said, we've got racing, we've got Six Nations, we've got Heineken Cup rugby and various other things. But about half of the Saturdays, we don't have anything. So would you go have us and put it on your service?
Yeah.
Whatever that is. Anyway, they said, good idea. Let's do it. We went over to meet Scudamore and we agreed the deal. So we were now successful. We hadn't really worked out the detail of how we were going to share that, those picks. I've articulated probably a little bit better to you now than I did to them then about that they were going to get the matches that we didn't want.
Yeah.
So I knew there was a bit of awkwardness left in that conversation. Still going to be a good conversation, but anyway, they rang me up and I went to meet them. And that was what I thought the conversation was going to be about. But they said, we've just acquired the rights to the Celtic League, which is now the, what is the URC. And so this was an earlier iteration of that. And they said, we're going to set up a sports channel in Ireland and we want somebody to run it. And we think you might be the right person.
Yeah.
So putting that together with my, well, I've just actually designed a sports channel and I had been in RT all my career, which was 16 or 17 years at that stage. And I thought that RTE and I didn't owe each other anything at that stage. I'd had a great time. Really interesting career, ups and downs, like everyone. But I was now ready for another challenge. And so I said yes, and off we went.
And was fear of failure a big driving force then in those early days? Because you had gone from, you know, the old permanent pensionable, as they used to call it, into the commercial world.
Yes, well, a couple of points there. One, RT at that stage, I was in that kind of generation before they, after they had finished with proper pensions and before they had gone on to resolve that issue, however they resolved it or didn't resolve it. But in any event, there was that, which wasn't as rock solid. But the other thing is, in order to, I remember people saying to me at the time, what a courageous move it was for me to do that. And I remember thinking, in order to, for it to be described as courage, you have to understand the risks. Yeah. And I didn't understand the risks. I didn't. Yeah. Like
naivety can be great.
Exactly. Wonderful. So it was like, I knew I needed to do something different. Mm. I knew, you mentioned in your intro about following in the footsteps of my dad.
Mm.
And you kindly put it as if that was in some way harder. Mm. And of course, there would have been questions on my part, was that like how much of my success achievement whatever is related to the fact that, you know, I'm an FO
baby. On the neck, yeah, and your name is Cogley, yeah.
And And I'm not naive enough now to think that it didn't help, certainly in the early stages. But at the time, there was a probable nagging question in the back of my mind. Well, like, how would I do standing on my own feet? So that was obviously a kind of a push. In any event, that decision was made almost instantaneously. I did need to go and talk to my wife, who is much smarter in all kinds of ways than I am, much less naive. But she was very supportive as well, as she thought it was a good idea. And, you know, really, RTE had been such a big place. I mean, it's a couple of thousand employees and so forth, big campus, and it is its own universe, really.
Yeah.
And I didn't realise what a small place it is until I stepped out of it. Or what a big place, you know, and contradictory. It was its own universe. And I kind of swaggered across into this startup Setanta world thinking that they had, boy, did they have an awful lot to learn from me.
Yeah.
And of course, as I arrived, it started to dawn on me that actually, there was one person going to be doing most of the learning here, and that was me. Mm-hmm. And that was true. It was a shock to the system, going from thinking about how you're going to spend a budget that is granted to you, and maybe arguing around the fringes as to whether it should be increased or somebody else should get a bit less, etc., to actually starting with nothing.
Yeah, and actually, you know, funding the budget, never mind working out how to spend it.
Exactly.
And do you think that's the biggest difference, you think, between commercial and state broadcasting, is that, you know, you don't have a check on January 1st. There isn't a check. You know, you've got to make the check first before you can spend the check.
Yeah. And I would say, without any disrespect to anyone, we found ourselves playing against the people who didn't have to generate the check or the funding. And that wasn't the way I imagined it. I honestly felt naively that this was going to be complementary to the ecosystem and that RTE would actually get better because there was a kind of a local competitor impetus to show how good they are and where at various things. But actually it turned into a bit of a dogfight. And again, I don't blame them in any sense, but they, as nice as they were to me as I was leaving, it didn't last for long.
Yeah.
and they got very competitive, and they threw a lot of resource, money, energy, they didn't like having a potential competitor on their doorstep.
Yeah.
When I say they, I mean corporate.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of the individuals...
It wasn't personal. It was almost business, not personal.
Yeah. And again, like, those guys were my friends, are my friends still. Yeah. And I think there was a shock in the first case because my predecessor in RT, legend called Tim O'Connor, who was one of the funniest and wisest individuals in broadcasting, big personality. He'd left. I took over from him, and then 4 years later, I was gone, and nobody in RT knew anybody or anything about the business. I had lobbied for corporate RTE to say, if I get hit by a bus here, you're not in a great position.
That old key man risk thing.
So give me somebody that can share the load and can be there in the event that something goes wrong. Sorry, I don't want to be suggesting that I was seen as being the person with all the answers, but I did have, even on a personal level, I had all the contacts, and I had all the, I knew where to ask, I knew who to ask all the questions, where it wasn't obvious who was going to step into that role. There were lots of people in the sports department who had bits of the jigsaw, and as it turned out, and I don't know if I ever said this to him, but Glenn Killane, who turned out to be my successor, I went to my boss as I was leaving, and I said, "You need to give him the job because he's the standout candidate, even though it may not look it from here, just in terms of seniority and whatever else. But you need to give it to him." And he went on to be you know, to do that job, do it very well. Then he moved up to be the MD of television there, and would have been a great candidate for director general. After that, now he's gone on to bigger and better things at the EBU. But I guess we had to suspend our friendship at that stage because it became very very commercially competitive, and neither of us would have looked great in any of the contests, being too pally with somebody who had just stolen our lunch.
And tell us this, then in those early days setting the business up, it was very much, they were the competitors more than Sky, were they?
Yes, very much so. Like, the relationship with Sky was a very interesting relationship because in a way we were complementary to Sky. We were in the same ecosystem building it. We must have had a very similar business model to Sky's, albeit on a much smaller scale. But Sky had, we bid against Sky for certain things, but if they wanted it, it was easy for them to take it. We found ourselves bidding, and again, Sky were very interested in Ireland, but they wanted the market to develop in Ireland, I guess.
And not necessarily be the ones that developed it. If you know, let somebody else do the early leg work and then they can come in.
Well, again, they probably didn't want to own everything anyway or be seen to own everything anyway. Again, they've never articulated this, but the fact that we, and then our sister company in the UK got into the bidding process and won. You know, TNT have a couple of packages now in the Premier League, but going back to before BT Sport, that was Premier Sport in Ireland, or rather in the UK, heading for 1 million subscribers in the UK. And again, when the UK business showed up on the main screen radar of Sky, they became obliged to pop a couple of torpedoes in the water, you know. But before that, actually, I think it suited Sky's regulatory as well as commercial agenda that they weren't the only ones there, but they were the big ones there. But RTE, again, all of the things that I was trying to get them to develop and maintain, things like Formula One, for example, when I was there, the Masters Golf, when I was there, every year, the Masters Golf depressed the ratings. The way television works is it works in sequences. So everybody comes in on Thursday night, they finish their football or whatever they're baking, and they switch on the TV and they're expecting to see comedy on RTE2, say. And suddenly it's badly dressed men. Walking around
nice garden somewhere.
Exactly. It's like, what's that? And the ratings drop. So every year I had to go in and battle. And then I had to go and listen for about 2 months afterwards while the ratings recovered from, that thing that I had burdened them with. Of course, there's another argument. You've got Rory McIlroy on a journey to winning the Masters, like historically and so forth. But like in the moment, you could see the commercial guys resisting that. You could see everybody else not wanting to be sitting too close to me when that conversation was happening. But after I left, things like that RTE wanted to get rid of, suddenly they couldn't release them from their grip. And they bid up a lot of the rights of these things that we were looking to develop. Yeah, because they could, and because I guess, and I don't want to patronize in any sense, because, you know, they ran a very successful organization and business. When I left, the sports department was better run after I left than it was when I was there. So, but there might have been, at least in the early stages of my time in Sinta, there might have been an RTE, again, me projecting now, nobody's ever said this, a gap that they might have thought that we were able to see something they couldn't because of relationships or whatever. And they didn't want us to have that. In fact, the one time that RTE, I used to write to them and say, you've taken the Premier League match, you've taken the Formula One, you've taken the URC or Magnus League as it was at the time, and the SPL, the Old Firm game. They're the only four items on your Sunday sports bulletin, and you've managed to find ways to cover or exclude the Setanta bug from your news bulletin as you're pirating these pictures from us. Like, that a coincidence that they're all going through the thing? And the one time that Setanta's brand got proper prominence on the RTE news was when the UK business collapsed.
Yeah.
And it was the big main logo over
everything.
Over everything. Yeah. And it was their lead story, you know, which kind of made us smile, Riley, at the time.
you mentioned that, and like Setanta Sport itself did have a meteoric rise, and you know, you could argue maybe flew a bit too close to the sun and then and came up, but then rose again out like a phoenix out of the ashes. So what was it like in Setanta Ireland when all of that was going on?
It was traumatic.
Right.
So the build-up was great. You know, hiring people, starting people's careers is a wonderful and still I am meeting and working with people who had their first day in Setanta back in the noughties and who are now top of the industry, and it's and that was wonderful and is wonderful. Having to retrench a business to keep it alive and let people go is the worst possible thing.
Is that the hardest job as a CEO, do you think? Letting people go.
I thought it was terrible.
Yeah.
I can't think of anything worse than it. At least, you know, business wise, of course. It's horrible. I spent 2 years, I would say, kind of hardly sleeping. Killed a lot of brain cells in that period. But again, I have to emphasize that the as bad as it is to let somebody go, it's worse to be let go.
Yeah.
You know. So I don't mean to be saying poor me. The experience was a grounding one though, and again, it's, you know, perhaps the growth of Setanta was meteoric. Maybe it was too fast. The Irish business actually.
More balanced in its sustainable growth path.
Well, look, I wasn't involved in the UK business. I don't know what happened in the shareholder meetings or the board meetings even. But the Irish business was sustainable in the form that it had evolved to until the UK. It wouldn't have got there without the UK business being there, you know.
Yeah.
So we were getting rights.
It was a bit of a symbiotic relationship, albeit
more than a bit.
Yeah,
because the Irish business was able to acquire the 3PM package, as it turned out, on its own and fund it, and the other rights that it bought for Ireland. But it wouldn't have had any chance of being able to buy the other packages, the Saturday 5:30 for the UK and Ireland, and those were very significant in the speed of growth of the business in Ireland. When the UK business then collapsed, it made, so some of the guarantees that were there under the Irish business relationship with the Premier League, for example, they were just taken. They made no distinction. And then the Premier League didn't want to talk to us. Mm. And oddly enough, we had to go back and say, we're still alive.
We kind of are them, but we're not them.
Well, they were gone.
Yeah.
With all of the consequence for the Premier League. Yeah. And we had to make the rather lame, but actually not untrue case that net-net, if it hadn't been for Setanta in the UK and Ireland, they wouldn't have been able to get the same price from Sky. Escalating, you know, incrementing over the years. Yeah. So net-net, what they lost when Setanta disappeared in the UK was less than what they gained while Setanta was there beforehand. Again, that's kind of you're in a terrible situation when you're trying to make that case. Yeah. But more importantly, when they brought the 3PM package back to the market in Ireland, Setanta were the only credible bidder for that package.
Yeah.
So they managed to get over themselves after first excluding us from the process. They then said, "Okay, let's take another look at that." Mm-hmm. And the company in Ireland, again, largely thanks to one of the independent shareholders who had nothing to do with the UK business, Dennis Desmond, who was another absolute rock during that period. But the Irish business survived. And then I spent maybe 2 years with the business, keeping it alive in a much lower key level than the heights that it had reached. When I say keeping it alive, again, I'm sounding like it was just me. But actually, I probably had gotten to the stage then, not probably, I had gotten to the stage where I had fallen out of love with that, just keeping it alive, and was ready for another challenge when the next one came along.
And you know, when you look at this, the starting point in Satan Sport Ireland, you know, was it did it have the feel of a very entrepreneurial startup type thing? In which case, you know, and the one big question, I suppose, how many people were around you to do the core functions, or were you doing all of the core functions at those early stages as the CEO?
Yeah, everything. From startup, it was literally, here's a desk. What about a laptop or a desktop? Yeah, sure, go on.
Go and get
one. Go and figure that out, you know. Now, in fairness, and again, most importantly, I'm not a numbers guy. I'm not a finance guy, and I wouldn't even describe myself as being a business guy. And the Satanta team at that stage already had a number of people who were very good at that, very good at finance. They had been functioning as a business for a number of years, and they had already expanded into the world of the SPL. So they actually knew a lot more about the business than I did. I was good in studio at matches and
content production, if you will.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, that's what I am. I'm a TV producer, director. So I didn't have to think too hard about, are my numbers right? I was able to get the benefit of a series of good, and in some cases, very good financial directors who sat with me and challenged me and enabled us to build a plan that actually made sense and was, you know, because one of the interesting contrasts between these two, maybe I'll tell you a backstory first. So in 1999, I went to Australia at the invitation of one of the senior members of the GAA. They were going over there for a international rules event, and I was looking for some real FaceTime with their top people. And this guy said, the only time you'll ever get that group of people
in who, one place,
who don't have another set of agendas, the only time you're going to get their attention is if you go to Australia. So I went over, and I sat down with Liam Mulvihill and a number of the top president, the provincial council chairman, so forth. And I just made the case for RTE that as much as the relationship had been a adversarial relationship over the years, that net-net, RTE's contribution was more than their commercial upside. And I invited them to come and have a proper look or send somebody in to see that detail. The difference was quite substantial. And I said that we wanted to continue that relationship, and we knew that they had other options emerging and thing, but we actually wanted to make the case that strategically, and gave them the opportunity to say other things if they wanted to, and gave me the opportunity to say one or two other things as well. So, but they'd given me the whole morning, and I met them at 9, and at 9:45 they seemed to be in agreement. So I left. I didn't want to change their mind back. And I bumped into a old pal of mine from a different code, and he was just totally randomly, as I was walking back, there was a Rugby World Cup on at the time. And I bumped into this guy, and we went for coffee, and he asked me the question. He said, how do you pay so little compared to the the likes of Sky. And on the back of a napkin, I worked out, I showed them that RTE starts, say, with 100 million, and maybe they give Sport 20 million, and five has to go to the GAA, and five to the FAI, and five to rugby, five to racing, Olympics, whatever. And that's it. So if I want to get another million to put into one of the rights, then it's going to have to come from news or young people's or something else. Sky or pay television, on the other hand, was you start with zero. And then you imagine if you had the Premier League, 3 p.m., how many subscribers would come in at a particular price. So if you decide that you're going to charge them a tenner, it's an easy piece of arithmetic to say if you get 100,000 Irish people who will give you a tenner a month, maybe not for June and July. And that piece of arithmetic was so simple. And he went, oh, I understand that. So if you, and if you think you can drive that to 150,000, there's another chunk of change that could be put into the rights packet. So that's how pay television works out its budget and its spend on rights. And you can see there's no comparison with the free television who are locked into their budgets. And he seemed to understand that. And as I walked away from that coffee with my friend, I thought that I had just persuaded the GAA to stay with free television. And I had just persuaded myself that maybe it wasn't my future. So the processes are very different. You can see it's not a fair fight in that in that context. And again, notwithstanding what I was saying about how RTE leaned in to protect their space, you could see how they felt potentially exposed in a runaway pay television market that they wouldn't be able to defend their most important things. So.
And then when you move to the broader commercial TV in terms of TV3, is it, again, a very different world from the sports dedicated one, working on that same kind of metrics because you have lots of different interests that you're then kind of going, well, if I can get, you know, X amount of people to watch Emmerdale and another X amount of people to watch such and such, you've basically got the whole gamut to deal with now.
Yeah, so TV3 was another eye-opener again. I was going in thinking I now knew everything. And of course, this was a whole new world because RT was a semi-state institution, City Hall. Satanta was a startup, nothing that had gone through peaks and troughs of success and failure and rejuvenation. But it was pay. And therefore, some of the things I've just described applied in terms of what's possible. TV3 was totally advertising based.
Okay.
And their budgets were even more difficult than either the budgets I've just described. Getting people to sign direct debits is hard.
Hard, yeah.
Getting advertisers to assign their budgets and justify them on the basis of Nielsen measurements is hard too. And as you say, the likes of Coronation Street and things like that are a staple diet of theirs to get certain demographics. And I guess one of the things that I tried to persuade and didn't meet any strong resistance in TV3 was the fact that the demographics bringing sport into the mix was going to broaden their range of sales opportunities and consolidate their business from not becoming a housekeepers with kids mostly demographic. But that's a whole world of complexity that I really wouldn't pretend to understand. Pat Kiley, who went on to be CEO of that business, and David McRedmond were both tremendous leaders in their respective roles and areas. And again, the amount I learned from those guys and the rest of the team at TV3 and Virgin Media was, again, it was as you indicated, big old Irish institution, semi-state, startup, kind of troublemakers, disruptors, and kind of making it up as you go along. And then you have TV3, who were the disruptors and who were...
had matured slightly.
Well, they had matured, but they were still in a battle. And again, yeah. also owned by private equity at the yeah. time. Dairy Hansen they had bought the company from Can West. Mm. And they had targets that weren't easy and expectations. And that was a tough, tough business. Mm. Like barely surviving, I would say. And then on top of the various... Now, so the first job they got me to do was to produce a sports event, which they had inherited the obligation to produce the Europa League final in Lansdowne Road, which came with a bundle of rights that they had bought in European football. And this was a very unlikely event to happen. But then John Delaney managed to get the Europa League final yeah. here. And then for a long time, it looked like Liverpool were playing it. And it turned out Liverpool were beaten by, I think it was Braga in the yeah. semi-final. And it turned, talk about anti-climax.
Yeah.
But the cost to doing that was still epic, to have put in 30 camera coverage. And they needed somebody who would help them contain those costs and manage to deliver it without, because they didn't, at the time, they weren't doing any sport. But the second thing they got me to do was to build a HD studio. So even though they were struggling in a very difficult environment, again, like the crash in 2008 had a devastating effect on commercial spend. Mm. You know, the first things that go in most businesses is your marketing.
When, yeah.
And every Irish business was struggling, not just Irish business. So in that period of 2012, 13, 14, it was tough. It's very tough. And then in about 15, I think UTV decided they were going to take over in the Irish market. Mm. And that made another tougher, and no better man than Dave McRedman to fight the rear guard on that and to keep that business going. But it was, you know, it was a tough period of time professionally. As I say, they do say that you learn from your mistakes.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you, what do you think a mistake you learned most from, and how did you apply the lessons? When you think back in your career, is the one thing you just kind of go, that was a real school day?
trying to pick one. Well, I guess maybe my most celebrated cock-up probably would have been losing the rights, the FAI rights, back in about 2003. Mm-hmm. And that kind of wasn't my fault. It was my fault. I was the one in position. But FAI got a counter bid from Sky and they wanted it. It would have been just before John Delaney's time. And now, having lived in the pay sports world and working with lots of federations, I think they were probably right to want it.
Okay.
You know, it was a big cash offer, and every federation needs cash to build and to develop and so forth. And they asked for this amount of money. I remember bringing my big boss into the meeting with them, the defining meeting, and asking them to spell out. So when they said they wanted this amount of money, did that mean that they were giving us permission to generate that amount of cash but stop doing everything, League of Ireland, internationals, etc., production, etc., etc.? And they were saying, no, you need to keep doing that and give us this big figure. And of course, that wasn't going to be in our gift to do.
But do you think some of those sports federations, you know, you say to yourself commercially, you can understand why they do. But do you ever think that it's a bit of a deal with the devil? That they make a deal with the devil that they may regret, and that they look at it and go, oh, well, Sky's going to come on. It's going to be great to showcase our sport, to do all of this. And actually, when they look back on the experience, it's not really what they thought. It doesn't end up being what they thought it was going to be. Yes, they got a lot of money, and if they use the money very well, great. But the alternative benefits that they thought they were going to get just never come.
Having lived on all sides of this, yeah. I would say I would say that many federations struggle with this. Mm-hmm. There's another thing they struggle with too, but do you want money? Do you want relevance? Do you want to be covered? Do you want coverage or do you want cash? And the answer for many federations is, well, actually we want both.
Mm.
And the question they then have to decide is, how do they achieve a balance between those two things? Because you can't survive without cash.
Yeah.
And you want to stay relevant.
Yeah.
You know, again, one of my former colleagues used to have a nice expression for it. Is this going to make me rich or is it going to make me famous?
Yeah.
And, you know, the answer to that is, well, can I be rich and famous, or a bit of both? So, no, I think, if your organization isn't well organized, if you don't have a good foundation, you don't have a good strategy, money's probably not going to make you a better.
And it's more likely to be wasted.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like the GAA and the IRFU, I would say, and I don't mean to be ungenerous to anyone I'm not mentioning there, but the IRFU did something. I'm not quite sure what, but I have an idea. Back in the late 90s, they produced a strategic plan. And if you recall, the 80s and 90s, when I was growing up, a great season for Irish rugby was beating Scotland or Wales.
Yeah.
Well, a good season was beating Scotland or Wales. A great season was beating both Scotland and Wales. Beating England and France was a total aberration. We did it in 82 and 85 to win a Triple Crown, or just England. And since the new millennium, like the Irish team is in the top one or two every year consistently. So they did something and they seem to be well managed. And I'm sure there are lots of people who deal with the IRFU who would have very strong contrary things to say about this because the GAA as well, if you see what they have done, building Croke Park, that happened during my time with them. And they were, unlike most worldwide federations, they came to television and they said, what do we need to do or not do when we're building this? You can see what they've done with development of the game in Dublin, for example. So a fantastically well-run organisation. Not perfect, lots of, again, you can look around. But to answer your question, if you inject money into something that's already on a good trajectory, then that is more likely to have compounding positive effects. You drop cash into something that is shaky or poorly has poor foundations, then the chances are it'll make it worse.
You set up your own company in 2017. Was that always the plan, even back in the RTE days, or is that kind of, was that just the natural progression of everything that went before?
It was time. I like to see my career in terms of 3 to 5 year stints. I kind of feel that if you haven't achieved what you set out to achieve after 5 years, there's a really good chance you're not going to. And if you have, then part of that should be developing the next generation and giving them space to bring their ideas to bear. And I felt that way about RTE. I felt that way about the head of sport in RTE. I kind of couldn't wait to get my hands on the keys. I felt I left it in a place as least as good as I found it. I felt the same in Setanta, that it had been an overall wonderful experience for me, notwithstanding the pain of the last couple of years. So I think you got to keep changing. It was time for me to move on from Virgin Media as well. When that had happened again, they had I had done a lot of jobs there. A lot of them I wasn't very good at, actually, because there was so much transition and change there. And it was time to let the next generation to step in and do them, including sport. The portfolio in sport was non-existent when I arrived. Sport wasn't my... It was never mentioned as part of my job over there, but as it turned out, it became quite a lot of it. So in 2017, it was just time. And I saw an opportunity, and I saw a need. I saw the cliche about there being a gap in the market. I was never quite sure there was a market in the gap. But there was one for maybe 3 years. And then I reckon there was kind of 5 or 6 years in that. And then COVID happened and kind of foreshortened it a little bit, but it was finite anyway. And then COVID passed and it was time to go and do something else. And I already had this vehicle that that was there. So that's what I'm doing now. It's a project that, again, there is a need for it and there is a gap in the market. The market in the gap is evolving. But there are a lot of sports that are not in the television ecosystem. And frankly, probably won't ever be to the point that they will be satisfied by that. And being on the periphery of the television sports market is nearly worse than not being near it, in the sense that it's very hard to get a broadcaster to commit, because if you don't have a sequence of events, we talked about this a little bit earlier, that fit the needs and timings and reliability of the broadcaster, then the chances are it's going to be hard to build one.
Yeah.
So at the same time, there's now a world of live streaming that can enable you to get your event covered, if not for broadcasting, then for some other platform. And what my current business, All of Us is the brand name, is now doing, is trying to fill the gaps between somebody bringing their iPhone and pointing it at an event and streaming it, all the way up to having to spend 50 or 100,000 a day putting TV truck into cover an event for an international broadcaster. And I kind of try and help to do all of those things without trying to replace any of the people who are already there, and just try and put it together.
That analogy about, you know, being on the fringes of the TV ecosystem, for all of those sports, they were pointing and trying to get into the middle of the TV, and now suddenly they realise there is a world outside the TV ecosystem that maybe they're just better suited to.
Well, they're better suited in one particular way. If you are trying to court a broadcaster and it's a long shot, as in you didn't do it with them last year, then the chances are you'll finish up getting ghosted, or at least you won't get a commitment on time to be able to pull in the sponsorship and the other organizational revenues that come with being broadcast. Whereas what we're trying to do is we're trying to set up a series, a schedule where the event will get covered anyway. If TV want to come and take that coverage, it's there for them. If TV needed to be incremented, the foundation is good enough for them to turn 4 cameras into 10 or 15 cameras. It's the same model. Yeah. Or this model can get out of the way and let them come if they want to have total ownership and control of it. So that is just, as I say, it's a jigsaw, but it's a scalable jigsaw. And that's the business that I'm working on now.
Talk to me about the business of sport. Does it take away from the sport itself, do you think?
Does it take away? Well, mostly I would say it enhances.
Right.
Mostly, the sport wouldn't be happening if it wasn't for the business of it. The First Division English football was nothing like the quality of the Premier League back in the good old days. Everybody likes to look back and you know, remember when things were glorious. But mostly they weren't glorious. They were good, but the GAA back in my very early career were very resistant to allowing television coverage of anything beyond the All-Ireland finals, semi-finals, maybe. Because they could see a risk that people would stay at home because you can see it better on TV. And actually the opposite happened. And there are very interesting study of how that can be counterintuitive. It getting onto television, national television, getting that exposure made people talk about it. And suddenly, you know, their attendances went up, even though there was television there. So I think on that level, it helps. It adds. On the level of television owning it and corrupting it, I think you could probably say that that's a risk. I mean, you're looking at the World Club Championships at the moment. You're looking at America getting the World Cup next year. People playing. We can recall back in 94 when poor old fair-skinned Steve Staunton
got roasted in Giant Stadium.
In Orlando, yeah, in Giant Stadium. Like, the temperature must have been 33 degrees and, like, he was practically wearing a handkerchief on his head. I do you remember he had a white cap on? So, like, that's a really good example of the business of sport getting in the way of sport. So, yes, it does. And again, there's other elements to it because, you know, you have to imagine that where big money gets involved, you have big corruption. Like, I work with cricket and there is a worldwide phenomenon where people are betting on cricket. They're betting on everything. They're betting on the weather. They're betting on the run rate. They're betting on the number of no balls. They're betting on the boundaries. They're betting on everything.
If there's a stat, they can bet on it.
And very often you get a match that's been covered in Ireland that nobody knows about. And it's going as a signal, as a television coverage image, going into a betting industry in somewhere in the east, Sri Lanka, or somewhere outside the Indian market, but pointed at the Indian market, call it that way, the scale of that. So you might have a mosaic of matches going on and you'd have people betting on which combination, you know, doing Yankees on these various matches. And if they can get information before it shows up on the mosaic or into the numbers, the algorithm of the bet. Yeah. So you've got people who are working for those gamblers and the industries who are sneaking into matches with phones and they are saying,
he's just done this.
He's just done this. And the latency might be 5 seconds or 15 seconds before it shows up on the central command and they get a lot of money on it and make a lot of money on it. So, so the potential for corruption and other problems in the context of big business and sport is always there. And, you know, we've say it ain't so, Joe. That goes back to the Joe DiMaggio days and when was that? Back in the 40s. So far, it's not new. And you have to worry about it, you know. And I used to think every time there was a power failure at a football match that somebody in the Far East had actually sabotaged it and they had a way of making sure that the match didn't finish and they didn't lose their money, you know. So, but again, that it's easy to become deeply cynical about these things too and conspiratorial about it. I wouldn't like to get carried away either. But it's there. So yes, it can have a range of very negative effects.
But at its essence, it actually has a positive.
Yeah. I mean, there's drugs in sport too, isn't there? So at the participation level, there's all kinds of risks.
Yeah.
How good the federations are at dealing it, how much of an appetite they have to deal with it, varies from one to the other. But we're talking about it. So
yeah,
it's better than...
Could you go back to the shop floor as a TV producer?
Sure.
Would you like to, I suppose, or you know, how did you kind of say, well, I've done that, been that, have the T-shirt, have several T-shirts and time to move on? Or do you, I suppose I always ask these people like you who have moved on, where your first grow was the production of TV. Does it still hold the same kind of magic for you?
It does. Nowadays, I don't get my hands on the keys tip often for 15 or 20 camera plus events. But I did really enjoy that period of my career when I was sitting in the truck or in the studio, having to make decisions, having to be the eyes and ears of the person sitting at home, and having to remember that there's somebody down the back of the pub who's also trying to see what was happening, and somebody who's glued to it, somebody who's in conversation and trying to remember all these,
looking at it, yeah.
Exactly, all these different audiences, trying to cater for them as you produce and direct. And I'm in my current business, I'm having the privilege of getting back in the truck on the hands on the keys, which is wonderful. Again, I don't know that I would want to go back to being, you know, doing that and nothing else.
Yes, yeah.
But it is a bit like riding a bike. On one level, when I went back to it, I was disappointed that the industry hasn't
progressed
beyond where I felt it maybe might have.
Yeah.
Especially with the new technology available now. But at the same time, that's an opportunity, and it is the opportunity, because you don't have to spend 50,000 to send a TV truck into an event per day anymore. And again, I don't mean to... very often, it is necessary to deliver the standards and the protocols, and for everybody to be sure that this is going to work without any risk.
Yeah.
So that is still a requirement, a frequent requirement. But it's not always, and there are ways to do this to mitigate some of those risks for much, much less money. Again, they tend to suit different broadcasters, different federations more than others. But I love getting back. It is my instinct is still to step into the space, look around, see what the layout
is. Always a producer.
Always a producer, always a director. Yeah.
What's your favourite sporting moment, either that you witnessed or you watched?
I think maybe the first thing that springs to mind is being with my dad when he was commentating in Lansdowne Road and Michael Kiernan dropped a goal to win the Triple Crown. Yeah. And I started to shout, "You fool." Because I thought he had an overlap and he should have passed it. But he took the responsibility, kicked the drop goal, and Ireland won the Triple Crown. That would have been 1982, I think. And I was 5. I can't remember which one it was. And I was taking notes for my dad, who was commentating. So that was a lovely moment to be there with him. I have been to so many sports events over the years.
Yeah.
I remember Zidane scoring a goal in the Champions League final in Scotland, which was just remarkable. Real Madrid were not the better team. Yeah. And then he just took this out of nowhere.
Sublime.
Yeah, I remember seeing Roy Keane play for Ireland, brought my wife to it, and Roy was just standout, the best. He was just so good.
Mm.
He seemed like he had just made the defining tackle. He had passed the ball out. It seemed like he passed it to himself. He ran up the wing. He crossed it, and he was there to head it in as well. You know, he was that good. So my favourite sports probably are rugby, golf, athletics.
Yeah.
They're the ones I dabbled a bit myself in mostly. Football maybe.
Right. Here is your question. We opened the book. The last question. Oh, right. Okay. If you were allowed to meet the 23-year-old you again for one chat, what's the one piece of advice you would give the 23-year-old you?
I would say be more confident, be less arrogant.
Do you think both have held you back?
Well, I say that be more confident in the sense that I was into my 30s. I think we were conditioned as a generation to think that Irish people weren't as good as English or American or somebody else. And it was only into my kind of senior role professionally when I was looking at that we were copying what the BBC or ITV or Sky were doing, and they were making mistakes. And we were then making the same mistakes just because they did it. And so I think if I'd known then that that we were not inferior, then if I think I might have there not necessarily been better.
Follow that you know, you wouldn't have blindly followed what you thought others were. There would have been a bit of critical analysis, if you will.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And the arrogant bit, again, I think I probably was also, notwithstanding what I've just said about confidence, kind of felt that I was right because logic said I was right. And in fact, there's all kinds of ways to be right, rather than just kind of mathematically or logically. There's a lot more intuitive ways.
You can win a battle and lose a war type thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So again, I've learned so much from my family, my kids. When you're looking at the world through somebody else's eyes, I guess you discover what you didn't know when you were that age, but you discover it in a completely different way. So yeah.
Alright, well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Niall Coghlan. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we'll see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.